Hey everybody, on this call I am extremely pleased to introduce to you Dr. Thomas Epperson. Tom is the president of Innerwill Institute and has nearly 20 years of experience as a leadership coach, facilitator, speaker, and regularly works with business leaders to help transform leaders in their organizations. Tom is a certified business coach, has a doctorate in leadership from George Washington University. That is one of the premier institutes around leadership coaching and development. And he is also an adjunct faculty member at Virginia Commonwealth University's Executive MBA program. Tom, thank you so much for being here with us.
It's great to be with you, Shane.
Now, I also had a chance to meet Tom personally. He and his organization partnered with a company that I was, at the time, I was the chief leadership officer of. And Tom's group came in and helped us rebuild our values in our organization and also did some consulting with us around how we deal, how we improve employee engagement. And we just got great results from that and loved interacting with Tom. He was a kindred spirit and deeply trained in all kinds of exciting things, at least exciting to me. And I know if you're listening to this, it's going to be exciting to you. So let's start here. Tom, what is your, I think you know this lingo pretty darn well. What is your why? You know, first of all, what's your big kind of vision for impact? Why do you do what you do in the world?
You know, it's, for me personally, my purpose is really tied up in three things. Number one, I want to be a great dad. Number two, I want to be a great husband. And number three, I want to lead and develop people. You know, and so when I get to the end of my life, if I've spent my days doing that, then it will be a life well lived. For our organization, we're really in the people business, and so our mission is all about developing better people, braver leaders, and a wiser world through values-based leadership. So it's really helping individuals and organizations to understand kind of what's most important to them, their core values, act on those values again and again and again, and to make choices that really align with the kind of person that they want to be and kind of why they're here on this earth. And so as an organization, we get to work in a wide variety of industries, really helping them have those sort of deep transformational experiences over time.
Well, you are, that's exciting stuff. And one of the reasons I obviously wanted you as a speaker on the summit here. Now, you are the president of what's called the Innerwill Institute. It's a leadership institute, and it's a nonprofit that is affiliated with another company, which is a for-profit company called Luck Companies. And their tagline, at least for a while, was to ignite human potential. And I love that tagline because every time I would I've shown your case study in some cases to clients, and I've said, here's Luck Companies. Their tagline is ignite human potential. What do you think they do? What do you think their product is? And everybody's like, well, they're a training company. They're like, you know, they obviously do leadership development or something. And when I tell them, no, actually, they take big rocks and make them into smaller rocks. They're like modern-day Fred Flintstone. they do like quarry mines. They're all shocked by this. So how is it that a company like Luck, which really is kind of your, I don't know if it's your sponsor, but I know the founder has kind of helped create and give birth to the Innerwill Leadership Institute. How did that happen? What's the story there behind a quarry mining company giving birth to this pretty incredible thing, you know, years ago? You guys have been in this for more than a decade.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, really started back in the 90s, and we're Luck Companies is privately held, so there's an actual Luck family. And at the time, we were going through a leadership transition, so we were transitioning from Charles Luck III to Charles Luck IV. And at the same time, we're in basically a construction company in the construction world, and so the construction field was going gangbusters, and so were we. And so we had tripled in size, tripled in revenue, tripled in geographic footprint. And as you can imagine, as we got bigger faster, the complexity of running the organization increased. And so in order to deal with that complexity, as Charlie Luck came into the business, decided to decentralize. So we took what was very much a command and control organization. You know, there was a very clear person at the top of the organization. Everybody kind of filtered up through him. And then we took that and then created a leadership team and built officers and teams that were supposed to be closer to our customers. So they're supposed to be regionally focused. They're supposed to be really engaged in what was happening kind of closer to the ground. which was great. I mean, that is great on paper. And yet, what we neglected to do is we neglected to really think through all the cultural and leadership implications of that. So we decentralized the business, and really quickly the culture started to spin apart. And you saw people fighting over resources, fighting over customers, arguing about who got to do what. You know, we got into this habit of having a meeting after the meeting after the meeting where you would come together, you would make some decisions, and then out in the hallway you'd make some other decisions, and then the bathroom you'd make some final decisions, and then whoever left the parking lot last kind of had the final call. And so over time, as the culture started to spin apart, as we got into some bad habits, conflict started to rise, and people really started to not like each other. So there wasn't a lot of trust in the organization. What we had built over 8 or 9 decades was beginning to come unmoored. We kind of lost our way. And along about that time, we decided, okay, this thing is going south. Being privately held, Charlie didn't really want to have that kind of organization. And so we started trying to find a way of fixing our senior leaders. And we probably went through 2 or 3 different interventions to try and do that. You know, we brought in consultants and we just chewed them up and spit them out. We brought in a new theory or a new tool, we just chewed it up and spit it out. Basically, the culture was rejecting any attempts to fix them. And so finally, one of our partners, Caterpillar, said, hey, why don't you go talk to these folks down in Texas? They're doing something pretty interesting. Maybe you'll find it interesting too. And so they introduced us to Holt Caterpillar. Holt is the largest cat dealer in the U.S. It's owned by the Holt family. The Holt family are, you know, one of the big owners of the San Antonio Spurs. And they had been working on their culture pretty diligently for the previous 10 or 15 years, started by Ken Blanchard back in the day. And so we brought one of their executives in to talk to us, and he got all of our executives in a room, basically said, I want you to write down everything that's wrong with this company. And so imagine these guys hated each other with a passion. They weren't getting along. They were pretty unhappy, and they were pretty comfortable with pointing fingers at everybody else. And so when he asked them, I want you to write down everything that's wrong with the company, they were just burning up their sheets of paper. You know, everything that's wrong, everything that's wrong, everything's wrong. And after about 2 minutes, he stopped them, pulls $20 out of his pocket, and says, all right, $20 to anybody who wrote me at the top of their list. Now you can imagine how that went over to a group of real low awareness, really conflict-oriented folks. And they walked out of that session with just this deep and abiding anger at this guy from Texas who had called him out for maybe the first time. So you can imagine sitting there, someone holding up a mirror and saying, if you want to make any kind of change in this organization, it starts with you. And that was really the very first step in our values-based leadership journey. And we started working on the culture, and we started working on our leaders, and we started doing all the heavy lifting that it would take to move the organization from what it was to what it could be. And we these kind of amazing results, you know, where we were more effective with our customers, we were more effective with one another, we strengthened our relationships with our vendors. And then after a few years of investing heavily in our culture and our people and in leadership, we started going out and asking, well, do we need to continue to invest? And all of a sudden, all these stories started coming out about the personal impact of the work. So people would say, hey, you know, it's made me a better father, or I'm able to communicate with my spouse in a way I was never able to before, or it's made me a better soccer coach. And because of that sort of personal impact, as well as a very clear business impact, we decided to keep doing it. And so this went on for the next 10 years or so, and then along comes 2008. 2008, we're a construction business, mining business. We took it as hard as anybody else. Over about 6 months, 60% of our business just evaporated. And so we ended up cutting the company in half and doing everything we could to keep the lights on. At the same time, our owner, Charlie Luck, he got sick. And so he was basically in bed for 22 hours out of a 24-hour day and asked all those really sort of cliched questions about why am I here and why do I exist and, you know, what does the company stand for while we're trying to keep the lights on. And so eventually Charlie got better, and eventually we stabilized the company. And so Charlie comes back in and essentially says the company has to stand for more than just making money. The company has to make a positive difference. I don't know how we're going to do that. Go figure it out. And sort of the one thing that we were good at outside of taking big rocks and making them smaller and digging big holes in the ground was this leadership and culture stuff. And so we said, why don't we do that? And he's like, great, go do that. And initially, Charlie charged every associate in the company with taking it out to their families and their soccer teams and their churches and their places of worship and to take it out to our customers. And very quickly, we realized that wasn't necessarily sustainable. And so we just decided to start a business around it. And in the beginning, when we started the business, it was really just giving it away in a structured manner. And then decided, hey, we want to make this thing economically sustainable. What's the best way of doing that? Why don't we start a nonprofit? Because it really exists for the impact. And so that's how InnerWheel was born. So that's the quick and dirty story of how a stone company got into this kind of human potential business.
Okay, so great. And what listeners need to know is that Luck Companies has independently verified much of the stuff they do. So InnerWheel will take all the work that they've been doing within a company and really test it out. That's like their test kitchen. And then they'll bring it out to other organizations. And within Luck Companies, you all have tested using independent, verifiable kind of HR global researching companies to verify you all have, or Luck Companies has had, some of the highest employee engagement in the world. You know, in a world where 30% is average employee engagement, and maybe nationwide 60% is what you would get for most employee engagement, you guys are way outperforming even the highest companies in the world, or at least it was when we were talking last. So I just want the listeners to know this is this proof in the pudding. This is real stuff. And with that, I want to turn now kind of so that you have sort of the expertise and the credibility established. I want to actually turn to a few specific things. Now, I know you guys do a lot of things for businesses, including employee engagements and values and vision and all that great stuff. And so I want to make sure listeners know InnerWheel does a wide range of things. But for this particular interview, I want to focus on an area that not a lot of the other speakers have covered, and that's around succession planning. And before we get into that, I'll just a brief reminder. You know, the theme of this summit is really called Leadership Next, and it's largely looking at this massive shift that is going to happen thanks to the rise of all kinds of new technologies, from autonomy and AI and robotics and deep learning. All of these different things are beginning to collide, and as experts estimate, we're going to lose millions of jobs in the next few years. At the same time, we're going to have billions of people coming online at even higher speeds than we're on currently. So that means new workforce, new creators, new customers, new people to have impact. So it's not all bad. It's not all dire. It's just everything is changing. And so when you're dealing with people and humans and organizational change, succession planning seems to be one of the big things you want to pay attention to. So first, just help us understand why succession planning is a key part of what you guys do.
Absolutely. You know, and so when you think about leadership, we've got this responsibility and opportunity to leave things better than we found them. And when it comes to leaders, you know, especially with all the different clients that we work with in just a variety of industries, that's one of the nice parts is we're able to take what we do and take it into everything from for-profit organizations to nonprofits to government agencies to the armed forces, et cetera. And so in all of those cases, the leader's job is to help develop and ignite the people around them. And one of those really key processes to do that is succession. And it's amazing how few organizations engage in succession and development, which is required to help those organizations both be competitive and sustainable and high-functioning in the future. I mean, it's almost as if we're all so focused on our day-to-day fires, whether it's the pressures of sales or the pressures of production or the pressures of serving customers, that we neglect to think about that long-term heavy lifting we've got to do to really get ready for it. And so when it comes to succession, I mean, succession at the end of the day is making sure, do we have the talent we need ready to step into key roles that can help us be successful down the road?
That's great. So what is it that you guys do? What, you know, if I'm a leader and I'm busy and I'm running and gunning and I've got a lot of things I got to handle, often the last thing I'm thinking about is how do I make sure that I've deepened my leadership bench. Obviously, it's pretty important. It's pretty essential. Massive changes are happening generationally, all kinds of things. But how do I even start? Where would I even start with a succession planning process?
Yeah. You know, so I really do, you know, when we work with clients, it really does start with their strategy. So where are they going? What are they trying to create? You know, and those strategic outcomes could be everything from how do we want to compete in the future to what does our market look like to who are the people that we serve if we're a mission-based organization to how are we delivering on that value. So it does start with strategy. And then it comes to, okay, given this strategy, what kind of culture that do we want to create that's going to support that strategy? You know, so if we've got a service-oriented strategy, we've got to have a service-oriented culture. We've got to have the kinds of people who can lead in that environment. So by understanding where we're going in the future, that gives us some clues as to, okay, what kind of people are we going to need in the future? You know, what do they need to be able to do? What do they need to believe? How do they need to operate? And then how are we going to get them? You know, because when it comes to talent, you can either develop it or you can buy it. And when you go to buy it, it tends to be expensive and it tends to underperform compared to the talent that you have already in-house that you're able to build and develop over time. But it takes an investment and it's kind of this long-term play.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty key thing there that is often overlooked. And I don't know, do you find this? So it's not uncommon in my experience when I work with clients that people will easily dismiss individuals in their own organization because they've sort of gotten a pattern of way of working with someone, and they just kind of assume like, well, that's not going to be the person, we should go find somebody else. Sometimes
right.
That's true. How do I know whether I should really take seriously? Because it is really costly. I think people also underestimate how costly it is to bring in new talent. How do they know? How could I assess whether or not is this someone I should take seriously, and have I maybe misassessed them, and I've got some of my own lenses and distortion that are causing that, or how do you usually recommend people deal with that?
You know, on its surface, it seems like it's a pretty simple, straightforward question. So how do I know if they're the right person? I think why it's such a challenge, you know, so first of all, a lot of us have kind of the grass is greener mentality. So we look at the folks that we've got and we see all their flaws and we see what they can do, we see what they can't do, and then we're going to get fixed in our heads, okay, there's no way this person's going to be the next CEO, it's no way that this person's going to be the next chief engineer or chief researcher. And so we have a tendency in some ways to write them off. Or we see kind of the bright and shiny objects working in another organization, and we feel like, oh, I got to go get some of that, some of their special magic, and then bring it in, and then I'll have their special magic. So part of it is, can we unwire some of those biases? Right? And so when you use assessments, like we use assessments with our different clients around, so assessments around things like personality and values, and we can measure people's levels of skill, and you can measure their ability to have kind of emotional intelligence. There's all kinds of assessments you can use to really get a gauge on people's actual talent. So part of it is,
can I interrupt and just get really
sure,
practical
please.
Then?
Yeah.
What are like the key assessments you recommend people look at?
So I'd say you got to start with number one, what are you looking for? So if it's a technical role, then you've got to understand, okay, what's the best tool that's going to help me measure that technical aptitude that I'm looking for? If it's more of a leadership role, then have you defined the kind of leadership competencies that are going to support your strategy going forward? So to give you an example, oftentimes we'll work with a tool from the Korn Ferry Hay Group called the Emotional Social Competence Inventory, the ESCI. You know, essentially that's a way of measuring someone's emotional intelligence, because we find that emotional intelligence is a huge part of kind of current day leadership, and it's going to be a huge part of leadership going forward, especially if things get complex, fast moving, et cetera. So that's one example. Another example
Great.
Is what kind of diversity do you have in your teams? You know, and when I say diversity, I mean, do you have a wide variety of people and experiences and backgrounds and places that are going to give you sort of this kind of technical edge that you're going to need. Because what we find is the more diverse groups are, while conflict tends to be higher, they tend to come up with more innovative solutions. And innovation is going to be the name of the game going forward. And so as you're building teams, do you have an eye towards how can I make sure that I'm putting together the right group of people with the right mix of backgrounds in a way that's going to help create psychological safety? Right? So Google's done a ton of research on their own teams. Kind of what they came out with is not really a shock, but it's, you got to have psychological safety. People have to feel safe and trusting of with the people that they're with. And so can you use a variety of tools to make sure you are building the right team? So one simple one that we use with our clients is a tool called Insights Discovery. It's a personality tool like Diggs, like Myers-Briggs or DISC. And it really just helps you understand kind of what kind of preferences do you have on a particular team. And then can you help that team based on those preferences kind of build a high-performing version of itself to build trust, to build a place of safety, and then ultimately to get a lot of work done in a short amount of time.
Great. Okay, awesome. Thank you. So just thinking through people who are sitting here going, oh, great, yeah, we need to do assessments. I just wanted them to have a handle on where would I even start to look for some key assessments and what kinds of things. So certainly the technical piece makes sense, but in a lot of ways, what's great about the work you do is the leadership side, the human side, really transcends organizational type, right? So whether you're working in military or you're working in business or nonprofit, the human factor really is the same, and therefore many of the assessments are valid across contexts versus like 100%. If I'm in the military, what I'm measuring versus it tactically versus what I'm measuring in a software company are vastly different things, correct?
Yeah, and you know, I like a mix of things that you pull off the shelf, so things that are kind of heavily scientifically validated that have kind of years of research behind them. So I think there's some value there. And then to have something that's really custom to your culture, the roles that you're looking for, the strategies that you have in the future, and to be a little bit comfortable with kind of the quick and dirty nature of them in order to make sure that they're pulling on the things that you care most about. So, for example, you know, in the clients that I work with, really helping them get crisp on what are your values, how do you define them, how do you operationalize them as behaviors. And then using that as a way of assessing, okay, once I'm really clear on the culture I'm creating, can I build a survey or an instrument or a tool that helps me really understand whether or not someone is a good fit for that culture and whether they're modeling the kinds of behaviors that I need to see in the future? Or can I put together, one of the things we do with our clients is, can I put together a custom 360-degree feedback survey that really helps me measure the kinds of leadership behaviors that I believe are going to be successful in our strategy in the future, and then use that to really understand where my folks are. So using a blend of off-the-shelf and then homegrown, custom-built stuff is the approach that I would take.
Awesome. Okay, sorry. So I had interrupted you there. You were flowing a little bit. So you kind of got, you're looking at the strategy, you're looking at competencies, you're looking at assessment. Yep. What else then? So let's say I've defined my strategy. I kind of know where I'm going. I know what the things are that I'm really looking for in people. And I've really started to then use that to decide what do I need to be assessing. And I've made some decisions around what the assessments are. What happens after that? I've done some assessing. What happens next?
So I think a big piece of this is, you know, do you know the key roles that are kind of those critical priority roles that you're going to need in the future? They might not exist yet, so you might have to create them from out of whole cloth. They may exist, but maybe the roles are changing. Or they may just be roles that you feel like are going to be really heavily needed in the future. And so identifying that handful of prioritized roles that you want to make sure you've got a deep and talented bench to support. And so in those key roles, that's where you're going to decide, okay, based on these key roles, here are the competencies that we need, here's the kind of culture, values, personalities that we need. Now let's make sure that we're assessing our talent pools to see if they're a fit for that. And what you might find is you don't really have a lot of talent inside the house to be able to serve those roles. Or you might find, oh, we've got a ton of talent here that's going to be a great pipeline for these roles with a little bit of development. So you really want to get a handle on your current workforce and then use that to guide either your recruiting efforts or to guide your development efforts. You know, InterWheel, we spend a lot of our time and energy on the development side of the house as opposed to the recruitment side of the house. But both are important. And you might even decide, hey, we want to mix. Like one of the things from the for-profit company that supports us, Luck Companies, we always want a mix of our foreman trainees. We want a mix of people who have kind of come up in the business and have kind of been groomed from the hourly ranks to be frontline supervisors. And we want to mix those with some external mining engineers. So we like to get sort of college graduates and have this be their kind of first job. So to have a blend of kind of homegrown frontline supervisors with this influx of highly educated college students, and we feel like that blend gives us the right talent that we need in the operations side of our business.
Yes, creative. So as you're looking at, you know, a succession plan, a lot of what a succession plan is really as much a development plan. It's how am I going to now develop people now that I know kind of here are the things I want them to get from and to. And you've talked a lot about kind of the customizable. You've also alluded to a few universals. With the rapid changes happening in the world and the rate of change happening, what new leadership capacities do you see that need to come online that maybe aren't so known right now that are going to be necessary for the future? And then I'm going to ask the same question, which is, what are those leadership capacities that you think it doesn't really change? Doesn't matter what's happening in the world, these things got to be in place. So first one is, what are the new ones, or can you see new ones? Are there new ones that you think, yep, these got to be in most organizations today?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So I think it starts with that word capacity. So when we think about leaders, we'll often think about sort of what are all the skills and experiences that they've had? Right. But what we find, especially in succession, like let's say you're going to go out and hire a new CEO, experience doesn't always get the job done. Just because someone has a number of years in a particular role, just because maybe they've had some successes in the past, does not mean that they're going to be successful in the future. So capacity is really a measure of somebody's potential. Like what are they capable of doing? How much horsepower have we built into that engine? And can we use that capacity in a variety of different ways? So rather than thinking of something as just purely technical skills or purely experience, let's think of an individual's capacity and their capability of what's possible. Kind of a second piece along with that is, do we have the capacity to deal with kind of a high rate of change? You know, so the military calls it VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, complexity and ambiguity. So do our leaders have the capacity to deal with all of that uncertainty, all of that quick changing kind of speed in our markets and speed in our processes and changes kind of in the population? Can people cope with it? Do they like it? Do they enjoy it? Do they thrive in kind of the environment where you don't have a lot of certainty for a lot of years? And then can we really assess whether they have the ability to evolve? So can they increase their capacity over time? What's their level of curiosity? What's their level of self-development? What's their willingness to kind of grow and evolve both as a human being and as a sort of technical person to grow both vertically and horizontally over time?
So it sounds like you could kind of categorize all of that in a lot of ways into just adaptability. They almost have to be highly adaptable in ways that historically adaptability wasn't as critical with the rate of change. Is that fair to say? Is that an unfair bucket?
100% Shane. So, you know, in our own leadership work, I mean, we focus heavily on adaptability and choice. So can you adapt to the situation? Can you adapt to the culture? Can you adapt to the conditions that you find yourself in? Most importantly, can you adapt to the other people and what they need? And then make conscious choices about how you show up. One of the big limiters, you know, I feel like when it comes to people's adaptability is just their willingness to see themselves in a positive light as well as sometimes in a negative light. So to really look in the mirror and have kind of a really clear view of who they are over time. So who you are today isn't necessarily who you are tomorrow, but can you kind of keep an eye in the mirror and watch yourself kind of evolve in a pretty complex and sophisticated way over time. And then secondly, you know, if you can see yourself that clearly, are you constantly looking at other people? So are you understanding what they think, what they feel, what they need? And then are you adapting your approach based on that diagnosis? So you're adapting to what the situation calls for, as opposed to all I've got is a hammer and everything looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, so one of the capacities you alluded to, I think that probably is a bit universal and a bit unchanging, is emotional intelligence. So I think you've already kind of spoken to that. Are there any other leadership capacities that when you look at the world that's about to kind of the tsunami that's coming our way of transformation and change that you look at and go, you know what, this part of being human holds no matter what's coming our way. So you got to work, you got to know, you got to have this. And one is certainly EQ, it sounds like. Anything else that you immediately think of and you go, this is something you got to carry forward?
You know, whenever they measure kind of what makes great leaders, at the top of that list is always integrity. And so time and time again, when you ask people what matters in a leader, do I trust them? When you look at what matters in a team, do I trust the people around me? Because when we have a high degree of trust, we're more likely to take risks, we're more likely to experiment, we're more likely to try new things, we spend less energy protecting ourselves, we spend less energy worrying, we spend less energy in anxiety. So with a high degree of trust, whether that's organizationally, from a team perspective, and even from an individual perspective, that frees up a lot of time and energy to spend on the things that we want people to be focused on. We want them innovating the business. We want them looking out into our markets. We want them being externally oriented. We want them being curious. And so I feel like integrity is going to be one of those constants. And it's undervalued corporately when it really provides a ton of kind of psychological foundation that we need to be successful. I think when you go into dysfunctional organizations, you go into organizations that go away and can't compete, you go into organizations where people can't innovate, somewhere you're going to find a lack of integrity and trust.
Mm. So in organizations, sometimes I find when I'm working with a leader, they have a high degree of integrity, but they have somehow, actually more often than not, are misunderstood by their people. And There's assumptions being applied and beliefs about that leader that may or may not be true. Have you ever encountered that?
Of course.
I just want to make sure it wasn't just me, like I'd chosen the wrong people. Okay, so if you have, there's two different things, right? There's reality and there's perception. There's behavior and there's perception. What is something that a leader, most leaders I know, have lived through the experience of feeling misunderstood, having motives applied to them they didn't have, having accusations they didn't have? What's something practical or tactical you see is really effective to help a leader convey the truth of their integrity to their people? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does makes a lot of sense. And the answers are both incredibly simple and then really, really difficult. You know, if you want to convey who you really are and be as authentic as you can, and my own research actually speaks to this, is it's not just being authentic, right? So it's not just being who you are, but it's about skilled authenticity. So it's your ability to be who you are with some skill. And so the basic difference is, like, think about honesty versus brutal honesty.
Right.
So think about being effectively honest and straightforward with people, being clear on kind of what you expect, being clear on what you believe, or the brutal version of that, which is you're clear about what you expect, you're clear about what you believe, you're very straightforward, but you set people on fire as you're doing it, right? Or you just leave them in shatters. Yeah, you're being honest, but you've had a really negative impact, which is undermining your own sort of effort. So when it comes to you really not having things that are attributed to you that aren't true, or having people making up stories about who you really are, or being misunderstood, number one, do you have kind of the ability to be authentic with some skill? And that requires you to be transparent. So you got to share what you think, what you feel, appropriate emotions. It means, are you getting feedback? So are you asking and being curious about what people think about you? Are you really hearing it directly? Have you made it really easy for people to tell you, you know, your baby's ugly? Are you acting consistently and aligned with kind of what you value, what's most important to you? As leaders, we're always on stage, and people are constantly assessing whether the audio matches the video. So as you look in the mirror and you think deeply about yourself, we work with clients on this all the time, is you say you believe this, but then your behaviors don't line up with it. And what happens when that doesn't match? People either lose trust in you or they make up stories about why the audio doesn't match the videos. And so it's so much better to just be as aligned and consistent as you can be about what you believe, right? So when people say hear you say something and then they see you act on it, they're going to be more likely to believe that you'll continue to do that in the future. But if people never know what you believe and you're constantly changing your mind or, you know, not being as honest about your motivations and your actions, then that's when we get into all of this sort of misattribution and uncertainty.
Well, and I like how you've made it really concrete, because sometimes the word trust is this very vague, and integrity is too, honestly. It gets kind of vague, sure, and detached and abstract, and it's kind of feelings that are like, well, I just don't feel like I trust you. Well, what's critical about that is that can be a real red herring, right? And what you've just said is forget about how you feel about it. Just observe the behavior and the actions, and ask yourself, are these words and these actions, are they in alignment, or is there a gap somewhere? And is the gap real, or is the gap perceived? And those are two big things it sounds like you're saying to get curious about.
100%. You know, I think the mistake that we make when we're thinking about businesses and organizations and leaders is we think that they are logical and rational. Right? And we love to say, it's not personal, it's business. Right? And we think that people are like robots and that A leads to B leads to C leads to D. And it doesn't matter kind of what industry you're in, we all feel like people are kind of these cold functioning animals. They are not. People are irrational. They are feelings driven. They are fear driven. They are completely illogical at times. And so can we get okay with the fact that people are messy? And they're going to be consistently messy. And our job as leaders is to help reduce some of that messiness as much as possible, help reduce and make simple where we can, because our jobs are as complex as they can be. And so rather than making everything complex, can we simplify something as simple as our leadership and our integrity and how we show up?
So great. Such great stuff. Okay, let's get I do kind of a little lightning round here. It may not be lightning round, but at the end, I've asked all the speakers these same kinds of couple of key questions, which I just think every leader at some point or another has to contend with, and it's usually, you know, not much fun. So first one is, and I think this is very relevant to the issue of succession planning, which is, how do you lower the risk of a bad hire? It's one of the stressful things any leader has to do, is they got to bring someone into the organization. How do you lower the risk of a bad hire?
The simple answer would be we got to make it easier to fire people.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about that then.
So we invest all this money, we invest all this time in picking the right person. And so let me assume you've done a good job through the interviews, you've been really clear on what you want, you found people who have shown up pretty well, your processes are all good, right? So all of that reduces by doing a good job on the front end. That's most likely to get you the person that you need, right? And there's lots of ways that you can make that process better. But then once you've got them, what happens if they turn out to be a dud? They don't fit the culture. They don't fit the job. Maybe they didn't understand. Maybe you didn't understand. Maybe something fell through the cracks. Maybe conditions changed, whatever. So do we have processes in place that set really clear expectations, really clear boundaries, lots of frequent feedback and check-ins? And so we want to make sure that we're giving that individual as much feedback, data, and information as possible up front so that they can make good choices and we can make good choices. Because, by the way, when we give people the right direction when they're new in a job or new in a task, it really, really feels like support. I mean, you know, I think Ken Blanchard had it right in the situational leadership model. When you give people the right structure, you give them the right direction, you give them the right support, then they thrive and they develop well, as opposed to we kind of throw people in the deep end of the pool and expect them to swim, and then all of a sudden 6 months later when they're not swimming very well and we don't like them very much, we're like, oh, God, what do we do now? We're 6 months in. We can't just fire them. And so there are different conditions that prevent that from happening, kind of whether it's at a government level or a union level, where once you make that hiring decision, it feels like it's permanent. So I would say, as managers, can we really stay on top of the processes that help us both pick the right person, and then if they're the wrong person, help them, you know, make them available to another organization or make them available to industry?
Great. Okay, so here's I'll ask one more question, a quick question, and then we'll talk about a resource I want to make sure we get to share with our listeners that you've got.
Sure.
So what advice do you have? What's the best practice for terminating someone?
Woo! You know, if I was going to put my HR hat on, I would say make sure we follow the steps. You know, so make sure you have your paperwork, make sure you follow the process, make sure you're doing all the right things from a legal perspective. But from a leadership and human being process, keep in mind that when we fire people, let's say we're firing them for poor performance, chances are they're unhappy. Chances are we're unhappy. And while that firing is hard on everybody and can feel kind of traumatic for both them and us, ultimately we're going to help them find something that's more likely to fit them, where we're helping them not get stuck with us and trapped in a job that they're hating, that they're disengaged in, but to go find something that they're really passionate about and that they're really good at. And so not seeing it necessarily as this terrible, awful event. I think another piece is we got to exit them with dignity, right? So if you're going to, how you fire people is just as important as how you hire people. And so if you're going to let somebody go, letting them go with a high degree of kind of courage and compassion, having the courage to make the tough call, but the compassion to treat them well and like a human being. I love the way that like the Netflixes and the Valves of the world, sort of these organizations that are kind of cutting edge, and I think Netflix has written about this, is they fire quickly and with a really generous severance package. The generous severance package is sort of their stand-in for compassion, and their firing people quickly is their sort of focus on courage. So if people don't produce, they don't produce at a high level, then, you know, we move them out, we move on to the next person.
Mm. That's great stuff. So what could our listeners get from you, just a free gift of some kind that they can get access to, get some information, get a little deeper understanding of the stuff we've been talking about?
Absolutely. So really two things. We'll put together, we talked really briefly about succession. So we'll put together kind of a giveaway where we can walk through a succession process with some tips on best practices for making them work. So for your listeners, there we'll provide that for them. The second piece that I would offer is we have an app that's online. It's also on the iTunes. On the App Store, that is part of our philanthropy, and in that tool has a variety of personality tools, and values tools, and some leadership tools, and some feedback tools, and it's really, really does align with the impact that we want to have in the world. And so I would say we'll offer some succession pieces, and people are always welcome to use our app.
That is so great. Well, I have to say, just firsthand experience, having worked with Tom and his team, you cannot go wrong by going and downloading any of the resources he has and he and his team have to offer. Tom, thank you so much for the time, your wisdom, your insight. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Shane, this has been awesome, sir. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
You bet.